You can't give up, Salwana said as they crossed a bridge over Grove Canal into the Erie district, her voice pleading. Not after so much. Finnerton was right, though. What's the point? I can already shape eggs as well as just about anyone. If I join the guild, I'll be doing it to climb up the hierarchy, nothing else. And what's there, even if I do become Grand Master? Sitting at the top of a tower, organizing the guild, while everyone else on the council waits for me to make a mistake? I'd have a million enemies and no friends, and nothing will change. I won't be helping anyone. Remember Ashwell? What it was like before people accepted that the Genistars could improve their life? Well, Macathran is 1,000 years along from that. You can't shape better Genistars. You can't increase the amount in use here. Then when you become Grand Master, you must push Genistars out on people next to the wildlands. The Eggshaper Guild can still make a difference to everyone beyond the Uguru Plain. You've seen what life's like in the distant provinces. Make it better for them, Ediard. Make their life as easy as it is for everyone here. It's too much, he said. I can't do it, Salrana. Most of all, I can't stand 7 years as an apprentice again. I just can't. I've learned the guild teachings. I've been on the road fending for myself for a year. Any position less than journeyman would be a huge step backward for me. I'm sorry. He could see Akeem shaking his head in that weary way of his. The guilt was terrible. She stroked his cheek, which brought astonished glances from passers-by. I'm not going to give up on you, and I'm certainly not going to let you give up on your own dream, not after what we've been through. I don't know what I'd do without you. You're welcome, she said spryly. He glanced up at the strangely twisted spires that jutted out of the ground like gigantic stalagmites. Even the smallest was higher than the Blue Tower. There were no windows or balconies, just a single entrance at ground level, leading to a central spiral stair. Right at the tip, they flared out into broad platforms that looked terribly unstable, as if they would snap off at any second. After the madcap bustle of the other districts they had experienced, Erie was almost deserted by comparison. With night falling, the devout were making their way to the central church of the Empyrean Lady for the evening service of prayer and thanksgiving. Light was beginning to shine out of crevices in the crinkled towers around them, washing the hard ground in a pale tangerine illumination. Ediard regarded it curiously, realizing it was the same glow that had lit his way up the stair of the Blue Tower. Somehow the city material emitted it without heat. "Where will you go tonight?" she asked. "I don't know. Find a cheap tavern with a room, I suppose." "Oh, Ediard, you'll be so lonely there. Why don't you go back to the caravan? Anyone there will be happy to lend you a cot." "No," he said firmly. "I won't go back." She pressed her teeth together in dismay. "Your pride will be the end of you." He smiled. "Probably." The Lady's central church was impressive, a large cloud-white dome with the top third made of the same crystal as the city wall. 3 wings radiated out from the middle, lined with balconies. "I'm here," Salrana said in wonder. Tears glinted in her eyes, and her mind shone with happiness. The lady herself lived the last years of her life here. "Can you feel how sacrosanct this ground is? It's all real, Ediard. The lady's message to the world is real." "I know," he said. The main door to the church was wide open, shining a broad fan of rose-gold light across the broad plaza outside. Several mothers dressed in splendid white and silver robes stood on the threshold to give a personal welcome to their congregation. Salrana straightened her shoulders and walked up to the first. There followed a long conversation on which Ediard did his best not to eavesdrop. It culminated with the mother embracing Salrana. Another 2 mothers hurried over at her long talk call. They all began chattering excitedly around the suddenly overwhelmed girl. Salrana turned, holding an arm out to Ediard. "They'll take me in," she said, her face suffused with delight. "That's good," he said softly. "Come, child," said the first mother, and put her arm protectively around Salrana. "Young man?"
"Yes, mother."
"We commend you for aiding our lost soul. May the lady bless you for what you have done." He did not know what to say, so he just ducked his head gracelessly. "Will you stay for the service?"
I have to get to my lodgings. Thank you."
He backed away and turned, walking quickly across the plaza. "Don't forget," Salrana's long-talk voice chided him, "talk to me first thing tomorrow. I want to know that you're all right."
"I will."
Even with the cold orange light shining down from the twisted towers, he was unnerved walking through the empty district. The dark upper sections of the towers formed black silhouettes against the glowing night sky. His mind kept firmly focused on the warm aura of human minds on the other side of the Grove Canal. Before he reached any bridge, he came to a decision. His far sight strained to reach the blue tower. The sparks of minds were very hard to distinguish through its walls, but he persevered and eventually found one he recognized.
"Excuse me, sir," he long talked to Topa.
There was a small burst of surprise from the man, quickly smothered.
"Where are you, Edyard?"
"In Erie, sir."
"And you far-sighted me through the walls of the Blue Tower from there?"
Yes, sir."
"Of course you did. So what can I do for you?"
"I know this probably seems sudden to you, sir, but I have thought over what the Grand Master said to me. I'd like to join the constables. There's nothing else for me here."
"Yes, we did make that promise to you, didn't we?
Very well. Report to the main constable station in the Jevons district. By the time you get there, they will be expecting you. Your letter of sponsorship will be with the captain in the morning."
"Yes, sir."
"Please thank the Grand Master for me, sir. I'll not let him down."
"Somehow, Edyard, I don't think you will.
One word of advice from a lifelong citizen of Macathran?"
"Sir,
don't let your fellow constables realize how strong you are. Not at first. It may attract the wrong kind of interest.
Politics, remember?"
"I remember, sir."
"Get up, you little turds!"
Edyard groaned, immensely tired, blinking against the orange light flooding into the dormitory. His thoughts were a confused whirl as reality intruded into the shrinking dream.
"Come on, up! I haven't got the time to nurse you pathetic tits! If you can't even get up in the morning, what use are you? None, which doesn't surprise me in any respect. I want every one of you dressed and in the small hall in 5 minutes. Anyone who doesn't make it before I close the doors can piss off right back home to your mummy again. Now move it!"
"What?"
Edyard managed. Someone walked past the end of his bed and whacked his feet with a truncheon.
"Ouch! If you think that hurt, wait till I get to work on your feelings, farm boy."
Edyard hurriedly pushed the blanket down and rolled out. There were 6 bed alcoves in the dorm room. Only 2 were empty. He had met the other constable recruits the previous night at a quick session before Che, their squad's training sergeant, marched in and barked at them to shut up and get some sleep, because you've got an early start in the morning. As he struggled into his shirt, Edyard suspected it was Che who'd just woken them. The voice was familiar.
"He's got to be kidding,"
said Boyd, a tall lad with lank blonde hair and large ears. The 4th son of a baker in the Jevons district, not far from the station, he was in his early 20s, and as he had seen his older brother take on more and more of the bakehouse, he finally had acknowledged that he was not going to inherit any part of the family business. His sisters were married, and his other brothers all had left the district to forge their own way forward. He lacked their entrepreneurial streak, so decided the only way out was the guilds, or signing up with either the militia or the constables. He did not have the money to buy into the militia, and his psychic talents were limited.
"Oh, no, he's not," Maxon said as he hurriedly pulled up his trousers.
His story was similar to Boyd's. He was the unrecognized son of a mistress to a grand family's patriarch. Usually such a father would quietly buy such an offspring a minor commission in the militia, or smooth the way for his entry into a professional guild such as the lawyers or clerks. Unfortunately, this patriarch chose to travel on one of his trading ships, voyaging south along the coast, where one of the Lyot Sea's rare storms blew up. The wife and the eldest son threw Maxen and his mother out of their estate cottage on the Iguru even before the memorial service had been held. Edyard shoved his bare feet into his boots.
"We'd better do as he says, at least until we figure out how serious the officers are," he said.
He looked at the locker beside the cot where his shoulder bag was resting, and briefly wondered if it would be safe. Not that there was much of value inside. And anyway, this is a constable station.
Chase Sirius, all right,
Dinlay said. Their final roommate was also a youngest son, but his father was a constable. As such, Dinlay was the only one to have a uniform already. He was doing up the silver buttons on the front of his dark blue tunic. The little metal circles had been polished to a sheen, as had his black ankle-high boots. The trousers were pressed, showing a sharp crease down the front. It was not a new uniform, but one had to look carefully to see any wear. Dinlay had told them the previous night that it used to belong to his father when he had been a probationary constable. Of the four of them, he seemed to be the only one enthusiastic about their new profession. He used a long talk whisper to tell them, "Father said Sergeant Che is a heavy drinker. He was sent to this station because he screwed up everywhere else in the city."
"So they put him in charge of training recruits?" Maxon exclaimed.
Dinlay winced, glancing about uncomfortably.
"Not so loud. He doesn't like being reminded he threw his career away."
Boyd chuckled.
"Career? In the constables? Aren't you the comedian?"
Dinlay gave him an angry look before putting on his wire-rimmed glasses. There was something about him that reminded Ediard of Fahin, not just his short sight problem, but the way he was so dedicated to his life choice, yet at the same time so obviously was not cut out for it. Ediard shivered despite pulling on a thick woolen jumper. He had not thought of Fahin in a long time, and his disturbingly weird dream left the memory of resurrected skeletons lingering like a bad aftertaste. It was an unfortunate combination with which to be starting his first morning. Not that it was morning yet, he noticed as they scurried down the station's central stair to the small hall where they would spend the next 6 months learning their new craft. The glowing nebulae of Querencia's night sky were still visible through the feathery curtain of cloud drifting in from the sea. Dawn was at least an hour away. Ediard still was not used to the way Macathran buildings blocked his farsight, so when they arrived in the hall, he was surprised that another probationary constable was already there, along with Sergeant Che. She was about his age, perhaps a little older, with dark hair cut shorter than he had ever seen on a girl before. Her face was rounded with chubby cheeks and what looked like a permanent scowl. Even by Macathran standards, her thoughts were heavily veiled, allowing no hint as to her true feelings. Ediard tried not to be too obvious in the way he checked her out, but when his eyes switched from her legs, long but thighs rather too plump, to her chest, he suddenly realized she was watching him. She raised an eyebrow in scornful query. His cheeks reddened, and he turned away. Che was standing at the head of the room under one of the ceiling's circular light patches. Thankfully, his anger seemed to have vanished.
"Very good, boys and girls. Almost on time. Now, believe it or not, this early morning is not designed with the sole purpose of making your lives miserable. I'll have plenty of opportunity for that over the next few months. No, today I want us to get acquainted. That means we'll be starting with some simple tests to discover the level, or lack of, your psychic abilities. This way we can combine you into a squad which together will perform a great deal better than the sum of its parts. And believe me, you will need to work together. There are gangs out there that will happily shred your flesh and feed you to the fill rats if you try and interrupt their activities." Ediard was not quite sure he believed that, and hoped his thoughts did not show his doubt. He concentrated on trying to achieve the same passivity that everyone else was displaying. "Constable Cancine, would you begin, please?" Che said. He gestured at the bench in front of him. There were five metal balls resting on the ancient wood. The smallest was the size of a human fist, while the others were progressively larger. A sixth ball sat on the floor, a good 18 inches in diameter.
"Which one?"
Cancine asked. "You just show me what you can do, young lady," Che said. There was a strong note of contempt ringing through his voice. "That way I can assess what duties to assign you, if any."
Cancine's face hardened into an even more disapproving scowl. She glared at the fourth ball. It slowly rose into the air. Maxine whistled approvingly and clapped. The other probationary constables grinned appreciatively. Edyard took a moment and joined in the acknowledgement. He assumed someone had given her the same advice about not revealing her full strength.
"That it?" Che asked.
"Sir,"
Cansine grunted. "Okay, thank you. Boyd, let's see what you're made of." A grinning Boyd stepped forward. The fourth ball quivered and rose a couple of inches above the wood. Boyd's brow glistened with perspiration. Maxen managed to lift the fifth ball. Dinlay produced a confident grin and elevated the fifth and second balls, which drew a heavy round of applause. Even Cansine joined in.
"All right, Edyard. Show them how the countryside is so much better than the city."
Edyard nodded slowly and moved forward. The others were watching eagerly. He was sorely tempted to fling the sixth ball right at the sergeant, but Topar's caution was still fresh in his mind. His third hand closed around the fifth ball and sent it bobbing up through the air until it was halfway to the ceiling. The others cheered. He lifted the second ball, then made a show of straining to lift the third, allowing it to hover a few inches above the wood. The first ball shot off the table and streaked toward Edyard. His shield hardened, deflecting it easily enough. At the same time, he dropped the three balls he was holding aloft. All the probationary constables fell silent, staring at him and Che.
"Very good, Edyard," Che drawled. "You almost convinced me. Little too much time between the hit and the drop, though. Work on that."
Edyard gave the sergeant a sullen stare. Che leaned forward. In a stage whisper, he said,
"I have friends in the Eggshaper Guild Guard, lad."
Edyard reddened.
"Constables should be honest above all else," Che continued, "especially with their own squadmates. Ultimately, your lives may depend on each other. Now, do you want to try again?"
Edyard pulled the sixth ball into the air. He heard Boyd gasp in surprise.
"Thank you, Edyard," Che said. "Now then, Farsight, I have placed some markers around the district. Let's see who can find what."
Edyard let the sixth ball down gently. He wondered what Che would have said if he had known how much more he could lift. The psychic tests went on for another hour, measuring their various talents, until Che declared he had had enough of them. Edyard was interested in the results. Cansine had a farsight almost as good as his own, while Dinlay probably could long shout halfway across the Yaguru Plain, a capability of which he was inordinately proud. Maxen's shield seemed disproportionately stronger than his third hand. Nothing Che threw at him got through. Boyd was all around unexceptional. It left Edyard wondering if he was above average or if his squadmates were distinctly below average. Sergeant Che's psychic ability was certainly powerful enough. Che told them to get some breakfast, then report for uniform fitting. "If any of you have money, I'd advise you to spend it on your tunic. Those without money will have the cost taken out of their pay for the next 6 months, and I assure you it won't leave you with much at the end of the week." They trooped along to the station's main hall, a long chamber with an arching ceiling and a big crystal window at the far end. Some of the benches already were occupied. A sergeant told them the bench at the far end would be theirs for the duration of their probationary period. The rest of the constables ignored them. G-monkeys hurried out of the kitchen, bringing crockery. They were adept at receiving orders, Edyard found when he instructed one to bring tea and scrambled eggs. At least the station provided their food. He wondered if he should try to long talk Salrana. The sun was just starting to rise outside.
"I've never seen anyone lift so much," Boyd said. "You've got a lot of talent, Edyard."
Edyard shrugged.
"I claim first rates to stand behind him when the shit starts flying," Maxen said. "And the bullets."
"You all look like you can handle yourselves if we get pushed into a corner," Edyard said.
"Don't have a lot of choice, do we?"
Maxen said.
"Not enough skill for a guild and not rich enough to buy into the militia. So here we are, all of us clinging to the ass end of life, and we're only just starting out. One big long fall into the sewage from here on in, my fellow failures."
"Ignore him," Dinlay said. "He's just bitter at the way he got treated by his father's family."
"Not as bitter as they'll be when I'm through with them," Maxen said with unexpected heat.
Plans for revenge? Kansine asked.
Don't have to plan. Those arrogant tuds break the law a dozen times a week. One day I'll have the clout to have the whole lot of the bastards locked up and ruined.
Now that's what I like to see. Ambition.
How come you didn't join a guild, Edyard? Maxine asked. You have more psychic talent than the rest of us put together.
I don't want to be ordered around for the next 7 years, he told them simply.
Lady bless that,
Dinley said.
We just have to grit our teeth for 6 months and we've made it.
That's a curious definition of making it, Kansine said in a dismissive voice, as a G-monkey brought her a tray with a bowl of porridge and a tall glass of milk. Being allowed out onto the streets by ourselves, to be shoved around by gangs and get beaten up by trying to stop tavern fights.
Then why are you here? Maxon asked.
She took a long drink of milk.
Do you see me being a proper little wife to some oaf of a tradesman?
Not all tradesmen are oafs, Boyd said defensively.
Maxon ignored him. Good for ye, he told Kansine. Her head turned ponderously to stare at him.
Not interested. Thanks.
Edyard grinned while Dinley and Boyd both laughed.
Me neither, Maxen insisted, but he had lost the moment and sounded very insincere.
So is Che right about buying the uniform?
Edyard asked. He was conscious that he probably had more coinage in his pocket than the others.
Depends, Dinley said. If you're definitely going to be a constable, then it doesn't matter how you pay. But if you're uncertain, then you're best off having them take it from your wages. That way, when you leave after a couple of weeks, you hand the uniform back and you haven't lost any of your own money.
Or face facts, Maxon said. If we're here, it's not because we're uncertain. We're plain desperate.
Speak for yourself, Dinley said. This is my family profession.
Then I apologize. I don't have the luxury of alternatives.
You could have joined the gangs, Kansine said lightly. It probably pays better.
Maxine showed her a fast hand gesture.
How bad are they?
Edyard asked.
The gangs, I mean. I'd never heard of them before I reached town.
Lady, you really are from the countryside, aren't you?
Maxine said.
When did you get here?
Yesterday.
Yesterday?
He said it in a voice so loud that several constables glanced curiously over at the table.
Yesterday, Edyard said firmly. Okay, well, too late now. The gangs are big in some districts and not in others. The majority are based in Sampaloc. If you're rich, they're not much of a problem. If you're poor, then it's more difficult for you. They specialise in protection. Think of them as an alternative tax system to the Grand Council.
But with violence, Dinley said. They're murderous scum and they should be wiped out.
After first being fairly found guilty in court, Maxon said with a smile.
There's a real problem, and getting worse, Boyd said. My brother is having to pay them to leave the bakery alone, and he's only 10 minutes away from this station, which puts him about as far from Sampaloc as you can be. It used to be safe there. My father never used to have such trouble.
Why doesn't he report them to the constables? Edyard said.
Maxen gave a disrespectful snort. Take a look around you, Edyard. Would you ask us to protect you from an organized gang that thinks it's funny to throw your children or your mother into the canal with a rock tied to them? Are you going to stand outside a baker's shop for 24 hours a day for 10 years just to save them? Do you think Che would let you? And if he did, what about everyone else in the district?
No, they're a fact of life in Macathran now. The best the constables do is maintain an uneasy truce and stop us from falling into complete anarchy.
So young, so cynical, Kansine said. Ignore them, Edyard. It's nothing like as bad as they say.
I hope not, he said in a subdued voice. Maybe he was still suffering from the shock of city life, but he had an uncomfortable feeling that Grand Master Finnerton had not been entirely honest with him about life in Macathran.
Chapter 5. Investigator Second Level Halron stood in the vault's open door and surveyed the chaos inside. Every surface, walls, floor, ceiling, corpses, had been covered in a thick carpet of blue-grey gossamer fibre, as if a million spiders had spent the night spinning their webs together. The slender strands were actually semi-organic filaments that had taken over 3 hours to neutralise the nerve toxin leaking from spent kinetic projectiles
and damp down several other lethal energy surges coming from munitions left over from the firefight. Halloran was mildly surprised that the St. Mary's Clinic would use nerve agents, but then important people did like reassurance that their secure memory stores were truly secure. He had told the clinic manager that he would be inspecting their toxic armaments user certificate at noon, a timescale long enough for high-level calls to be placed and the correct license to be procured. It was that kind of flexible interpretation of procedure that had earned Halloran his last two promotions. He figured, what the hell? The big boys ran the world anyway. There was little capital to be made from annoying them. That was why the police commissioner had handed him this assignment. And as soon as he got it, the mayor's assistant was calling him to explain certain political considerations, foremost of which was that the complete destruction of 500,000 memory cells belonging to the wealthiest, most influential people in the state had not actually happened. If there was a temporary glitch in cube data retrieval due to the unfortunate accident with the clinic's power generator, it was regrettable, but not a cause for alarm or excessive media interest. Reporters could cover the damage to the forest. They were not to be permitted into the administration block and its sub-levels. Harlan's U-Shadow completed its analysis of the gossamer and reported that decontamination was complete. "All right," he told the 8-strong forensic team standing behind him in the corridor. "I want a full scene survey down to a molecular level. No budget limit. This is way, way above our usual priority rating. Col, Angelo, you build the event sequence for me. Darval, see if you can get me the name of the memory cell that bastard Telfer was after." Darval peered over Halloran's shoulder. The emergency lighting projector that had been rigged up in the doorway was producing a silver-blue holographic glow throughout the vault, eliminating shadows. It made the gossamer shimmer softly, resembling a rippled moonlit lake, as its undulations smothered the congealed splinters of 500,000 cubes. "How in Aussie's name am I going to do that, Chief?" Halloran gave him an evil grin. "There should be one missing, so all you have to do is reassemble the fragments of those that are still here and tell me which one was taken." "Fuck me." "Good point. Plan B. Go through the names on the registry and assign them a probability of someone wanting to steal their memories. Start with political, criminal, and financial categories." Darval gave a reluctant nod. "Force fields on at all times, please," Halloran ordered. "There were some very nasty munitions loose in here. I don't want to take any chances." The forensic team moved cautiously into the vault. Examiners scurried in with them, bots like lead cockroaches scuttling along on black electro-muscle legs, bristling with sensory antennae that wiggled through the gossamer to stroke the surfaces beneath. Over 2,000 were released, streaming over the floor and up the walls to build a comprehensive molecular map of the vault. Halloran waited until the tiny bots had whirled around the corpse of Wirtz Aku before he gave her a more detailed inspection. Her cocooned body was still in a kneeling position, spine curved forward as if she were at prayer. They had found the top of her skull upstairs while waiting for the gossamer to run its decontamination procedure. Halloran knew what that implied. This was turning into a bad case from every angle. His exovision overlaid the results of the examiners, showing him the narrow burn lines on her exposed brain. A lot of energy had been applied in a fashion he recognized. He applied a deep scan module, tracking the depth of the beam penetration. Her memory cell had been destroyed. "I hope she backed up recently," he muttered. "What do you make of these, Chief?" Angelo said. He was standing in front of an exotic matter cage. "Nice idea, I suppose. I haven't seen one before. Telfer obviously didn't know they were here. Much good it did the clinic. Those guards didn't exactly slow him down, did they?" "No. His enrichments were off the scale." Halloran called up the main case file again. Telfer appeared in his exo-image, a picture taken in the main reception area, showing a possible Oriental ethnicity, but with odd grey eyes. Age locked into his 30s, which was unusual, and with a dense stubble shadow. Completely unexceptional. Halloran knew that was deliberate, not that visual features meant anything in this day and age. Even DNA identification was inconclusive now, and they had enough of that from the blood trail back up to the roof.
The picture showed him smiling as he greeted the beautiful young clinician. His accomplice, though, was a different matter. She certainly did not qualify as unexceptional. A real beauty with a freckled face and thick, dark red hair. Cute nose, too, he thought admiringly. People would remember that face. Everything about their arrival had been perfectly normal, right up to the moment when the clinic security net had started glitching and Telfer had vanished from the Smart Corps' passive surveillance. The raid, too, had been extremely professional, apart from the exit. The woman had seemed almost surprised, as if she were improvising the whole thing. That did not make a lot of sense. Chief, Darval called.
Yeah? The registry was hacked.
Harlan started to walk over to where Darval was stooped over the registry pillar. Several examiners were crawling over its gossamer cloak, prodding the top with their antennae. Has there been physical? He began to say. The sentence was never finished. A woman walked into the vault. Harlan gave her a surprised look, about to ask who the hell she was, suspecting another of the mayor's staffers because nobody else could get through the police cordon without his permission. Then her face registered, and Harlan did not need to ask. He knew all about this living legend. Everyone in law enforcement did. Oh, sweet Ozzie, he murmured, and an already bad case turned nightmare on him. She was shorter than most of the citizens of the contemporary Commonwealth, but the confidence she exuded was much greater than average. Harlan had encountered enough hires in his time to recognize their slightly smug self-belief. She was on a level far above them, with a composure that rated glacial. Her face was enchanting, a combination of pre-Commonwealth Earth's Filipino and European features, framed by thick raven hair brushed straight and devoid of any modern cosmetics, a beauty he could only describe as old-fashioned. That was fair enough, given the fact that she had not changed her appearance once in the last 1,400 years. The whole forensic team had fallen into awed silence, staring at the woman. Harlan stepped forward, hoping he was concealing his nerves. She wore a conservative cream-colored toga suit over a figure that was as ideal as any created by St. Mary's specialists. When he attempted to scan her, using the most subtle probes his enrichments could produce, they were deflected perfectly. It was as if nothing were there. The only empirical proof he had that she existed was his own eyesight. Ma'am, I'm Investigator Harlan, in charge of this case. We are very flattered you're here.
Thank you, said Paula Mayo.
Can I ask what your interest is?
It's not my interest. I am only ANA Governance's representative.
In this universe? Darval whispered to Angelo. Paula gave him a sweet smile.
The old jokes are always the best ones, and they don't come much older.
Darval's expression turned sickly. Okay, Halloran said. So what's ANA Governance's interest?
Mr. Telfer.
Is he higher?
What do you think?
His weapons bionics are the most sophisticated we've ever seen on Anagaska. The vault guards were hired purely on the basis of their enrichments, and he took them both out in less than a minute. So if he's not higher, he has access to the best the central worlds have to offer.
Very good, Paula complimented him.
So?
He's probably working for one of your factions.
Excellent rationale, Investigator.
That's exactly why I'm here, to see if that particular conclusion is correct. Now, I'd like first access to all your forensic results, please.
I'll see you get copies, of course.
Your planetary government has granted ANA Governance full cooperation on this case. I'm sure you appreciate the politics involved. Please feel free to check with your commissioner and even the city's mayor. But that's not copies. I require first and unrestricted access to the raw data, thank you.
Harlan knew when he had lost a battle.
Yes, ma'am. First access. I'll set that up right away.
Thank you. Now who's analyzing the registry?
That's me,
Darval said awkwardly.
Who do you think Telfer was after?
Darval glanced at Halloran, who gave a tiny nod.
Easy, actually. One of the secure stores belonged to Inigo.
Ah, Paula smiled. She closed her eyes and drew a long breath through her nose.
When was the last update?
The year 3320.
The year he left on his Centurion Station mission, she said. And he didn't return to Anagasca until 3415, correct?
Yes,
Halloran said. Living Dream Central Fane on Anagasca was built in Kumo. He was here to dedicate it.
Interesting,
Paula mused. You think someone's going to full clone him? Why else would you steal his mind? Paula said. Thank you for your cooperation, Investigator. And I'd still like those results as they come in. She turned and started to walk out of the vault.
That's it? Halloran asked.
Paula halted, tipping her head to fix the investigator with a level stare.
Unless you have something else to add.
What about Telfer?
Good luck hunting him down.
Are you going to help us?
I won't put any obstacles in your way, political or otherwise.
She left the vault, leaving Harlan staring at his team in confusion and indignation. Paula walked out of the administration block and glanced at the forest. The air blasts had produced superficial damage. Most of the clinic's buildings were still intact, and while the larger trees had been toppled, there were still enough younger ones to maintain the forest once the dead trunks had been cleared away. A police cordon extended for several hundred yards, with uniformed officers reinforcing the patrol bots. Members of the clinic ground staff were working with contractors and forestry bots to clear the worst of the damage. Little curls of smoke were drifting upward from the blackened ground, where fires had burned for a couple of hours during the night, before being extinguished. She did not pause as her field effect scanned the area, but two of the contractor crew were red-tagged by her U-shadow. Both of them were shielded, utilizing sophisticated deflection techniques available only to high-grade bionics. Hers, of course, were even more advanced. They were keeping their distance from the cordon, but her eyes managed to zoom in and snatch a facial image. Her U-shadow produced a cross-reference for both of them in less than a second. Once upon a time, about 1,000 years earlier, Paula would have confronted them there and then. These days she liked to think she had mellowed somewhat, although in truth it was more advantageous to let them think she had not spotted them. Paula had been born on Huxley's Haven, a unique world funded by the Human Structure Foundation, which genetically modified all citizens so that they would fit into a simple social structure framed within a low-technology civilization. To the horror and dismay of the rest of the Commonwealth, what they condemned as genetic slavery actually worked, producing a population that was mostly happy with their predetermined lot. The few malcontents were kept in order by police officers who received specific psychoneural profiling. Among other traits was a variant on obsessive-compulsive disorder to ensure that they never gave up the chase. The Foundation had created Paula to be one of them, but she had been stolen from a birthing ward by a group of radical liberals intent on liberating the poor slaves. She had grown up in the Commonwealth at large, first becoming an investigator in the Serious Crimes Directorate, and then, for the last 700 years, acting as an agent for ANA governance. Huxley's Haven still existed, its society chugging quietly along on its ordained course without changing or evolving. The Greater Commonwealth had very little contact with it these days. Paula herself had not been back for over 300 years, and that, essentially, had been nostalgia tourism. There was no need to keep an eye on it. ANA governance was very protective of non-higher cultures. It was a policy that, ironically, gave Paula very little opportunity to return. Her designated task of preventing the ANA factions from pursuing their illegal interference among the external worlds kept her incredibly busy. Her U-shadow established an ultra-secure link to Justine Bonelli. "I'm at the Anagasca Clinic," she said. "And?" "We were right. The raid was organized by a faction." "Any clues which one?"
"Well, Marius and the delivery man are hanging around outside, which implies they are as interested as we are. Ergo, they didn't do it."
"Don't be so sure.
I've never known the accelerators and the conservatives to be so blatant before. More likely, one of them did it and the other is trying to expose or counter him. You know what they're like."
"Whose memory cell were they after?"
"Now that's where it gets interesting." "Inigo's."
"Oh my. Really?"
said Justine. "I'm surprised Inigo left himself open to that level of exposure."
"To be exact, Inigo pre-living dream.
This is an old store.
How does that help anyone?
I'm not sure. The Conservatives will benefit if he returns and stops the Cleric Conservators' pilgrimage project. But there's no way of telling if he will. He might just applaud and join the pilgrimage himself. If one of the factions full cloned him, they'd be in possession of a puppet messiah. Very useful for endorsing your own agenda.
Except this won't be a full clone, Paula said. This is an early version.
I have a theory that might fit.
Go.
A full clone early version would presumably be able to receive dreams from the void, just like the original, which would give its controllers a considerable advantage over their opposition.
You mean they'd be able to reach the supposed last dream?
More likely, the new Sky Lord dreams.
Ethan still hasn't found the second dreamer, despite a phenomenal amount of effort. Did you know Living Dream is modifying every Gaiafield Confluence Nest it sponsors? And that's about 80% of the Greater Commonwealth.
They're getting desperate. The new dreams are increasing. They're not just fragments anymore. Whole sequences are seeping into the Gaiafield.
I don't think Living Dream is behind the raid.
They'd benefit enormously, Justine said.
Yes, but my U-Shadow has identified the woman assisting Mr. Telfer. It's Living Dream's ex-counselor, Cori Lynn, now persona non grata to Living Dream, and wanted for several body loss charges on Elezalin. The Commonwealth warrants are quite extensive. They also list an accomplice called Aaron, who shares the facial features of Mr. Telfer.
Now that is interesting. Any idea about Aaron, alias Mr. Telfer?
No, but the pair of them transferred to a starship immediately after the clinic raid. There's only one starship unaccounted for on Anagaska right now. The Artful Dodger.
What's the history?
Standard private yacht. Registered on Sholapur.
Oh, now we're getting somewhere.
Sholapur.
So in other words, we don't know who it belongs to.
Indeed. There's no real background available. However, the Artful Dodger was on Elezalin until just after the ruckus at the Riasi Fane.
Cori Lynn used to be Inigo's lover.
Could she be pining for him? A full clone would be one way of getting him back.
No, she's a pawn. Telfer is using her to get to Inigo.
How does an out-of-date memory cell help them get closer to him?
Enough people have tried to find him. He's probably left the Commonwealth entirely. Either he set off to get into the void by himself, or he's gone and joined Ozzy.
He hasn't joined Ozzy. I checked that 15 years ago.
I was always envious of the life you lead, Justine said. All that glamorous danger and travel. There's something intoxicating about it to a sheltered little rich girl like me.
How was Ozzy?
Like me. Essentially unchanged.
Who do you think this Aaron character is working for?
As you say, there are a lot of factions and organizations that would benefit by finding Inigo. This raid simply tells us how urgent their pursuit is becoming. Nobody has been careless enough to show their hand until now.
So what's your next step?
This raid is only one aspect of a much larger process of political events. I think it's important to find the second dreamer before Living Dream does. That person will obviously play a huge part in determining the outcome of the pilgrimage.
Wow. You still think big, don't you?
I always believed that solving a case is a holistic process. It's one of the few things I have remained true to in the last 1,000 years.
And what about Aaron and Cori Lynn?
That's the aspect I'll stay visible on. It won't take Investigator Halron long to identify Cori Lynn, and things will become quite public after that. If I start inquiring after the second dreamer, it will create too much interest amid the factions.
Would you like me to start looking for the second dreamer?
No. You're highly visible to the factions, almost as much as myself.
I think it would be best if you could keep an eye on the delivery man and Marius.
I'll do that. Who gets to track down the second dreamer, then?
Paula smiled broadly, knowing how the faction agents out in the forest would focus on that and wonder.
The last person anyone would suspect, of course.
The condition of the utility feed pipes in the third apartment was a lot worse than Araminta had expected. She had spent 3 unscheduled hours that morning tracing them through the walls and floor, supervising the bots as they ripped out the corroded tubes. It all made a great deal of mess, which meant more cleanup,
which meant more time not spent preparing the wall frames for the new fittings, which pushed completion back just that little bit further. Her U-shadow told her when it was 11 o'clock. That barely gave her enough time for a spore shower in the fourth apartment where she was living. Two of the old shower's 5 nozzles were not working, and one of the remaining jets smelled funny. She just had time to apply some freshener and dress in smart trousers and jacket before the clients were due. The perfumed spray damping her skin gave her an unexpected flashback to the day she had found out that Laryl had left Vyosha, and her liberal use of travel clean back in those days. All of that gave her a guilty prod that she had not been back to Nick's in ages. She gritted her teeth against stupid sentiment and went into the vestibule as the elevator brought her new clients up from the lobby. Danal and Mareble were dressed strangely. She wore a long skirt of wide weave ginger cotton, topped by a suede waistcoat with brass buttons that was worn over a plain white blouse. Sturdy brown boots were just visible below her swirling hem. Her thick raven hair was brushed back, its waves bound in simple elastic cloth bands. He wore leather trousers and boots, similar to hers. A yellow jacket was almost hidden beneath a brown overcoat made of an oiled fabric. Despite their historical appearance, Araminta could not help smiling as the elevator doors opened. There was something irrepressibly enthusiastic about them. Youthful grins, and the eager way they glanced around, the way they held hands the whole time. "Welcome," she said. The golden wood door to the showcase apartment swung open. She had dressed the apartment with a simple two-tone color scheme in each room, and had kept the furniture minimalist. The floor of the open-plan living room was an expensive ebony parquet. Artfully positioned tables and the chairs and settee were all reproduction Herfal style, with sharp curves and metal moiré legs, a popular fad 3 centuries earlier. The balcony was open, and it was a warm, clear day outside, showing the park off to great effect. Mareble drew a breath as they walked in. "It's fabulous," she exclaimed. "Just what we're looking for." Danal chortled, "Forgive my wife. She obviously doesn't believe in showing her hand before negotiations." "I did the same thing with the original vendor," Araminta confessed. "It's easy to become devoted to these apartments very quickly. I'm actually thinking about keeping one for myself." Mareble stood in front of the balcony door. "Would the one we're considering have the same view?" "Apartment 3 is on the corner." Araminta gestured along the balcony. "You get one aspect facing the park, as well as a view westward across the city. The suspension bridge is visible that way." "How lovely." "Can we see it?" Danal asked. "Not just yet. City health and safety codes won't let me take people into an accredited construction site. And it's a complete shambles, which might put you off." "Construction site? Are there structural problems?" "Absolutely not. The structure is perfectly sound. An independent deep scan survey file is registered at City Hall if you'd like to verify it. I'm just refurbishing and remodeling. Unfortunately, the city chooses to class that as construction because I'm replacing the electrics and utility feeds. It's just more file work for me, that's all." Danal gave a sympathetic sigh. "That sounds just like a Leslin. Dear lady, the water walker never had to put in requests to the Orchard Palace if he wanted to get things done. Try telling that to our government." "Now, darling," Mareble squeezed his hand more tightly. "He has a thing about bureaucrats," she explained. "We all do," Araminta assured them. "Thank you," Danal said. "So are you moving here from Elezalin?" Araminta asked. "Oh, yes," they chorused happily. "I'm a Confluence Nest technician," Danal said. "There's a lot of work going on upgrading the whole Gaia field right now. It's especially important on Vyosha."
"Why is that?" Araminta asked.
"The second dreamer is here," Mareble said. "We're sure of it. The last few dreams were so much more vivid than those first fragments, don't you think?"
"I don't have Gaiamotes," Araminta said, keeping it light, as if it were some minor fault in an appliance she was going to get corrected, praying it would not make any difference to the deal. She needed their deposit on apartment 3. They had not been as easy to sell as she had envisaged, and her suppliers were submitting payment demands.
Marebel and Danal both wore the same compassionate expression, as if they felt sorry for her, a concord that instantly reminded her of Mr. Bovey. "The Gaia Field is not something I could live without," Marebel said quietly. "I can always sense Danal, no matter where we are. Even when we're planets apart, that kind of permanent emotional connection is so satisfying and reassuring. And of course we know Inigo's dreams. Intimately," Danal said. He smiled with the placid bliss only the truly devout could achieve. Araminta tried to replicate that mien of joy. "I didn't know you could tell where a dream came from," she said, hoping that would divert them from her tragic defect. There was nothing the devout of any sect or ideology enjoyed more than making the benefits of their belief obvious to outsiders. "That's the thing with the Gaia Field," Marebel explained earnestly. "It's not all clear and precise like the Unisphere. Human thoughts are not digital, they're emotion. I had the feeling with the last few dreams of the Sky Lord. They were close to me. Now that the Nests remember them, they've lost that aspect. Not that they aren't still wonderful. We're all hoping that we'll experience the Sky Lord flying to Makathran to collect the Water Walker's soul. After everything he's done for the people of Quarentia and us, he deserves to rest within Odin's sea." Something about Marebel's evocation made Araminta pause, as if it connected with some old recollection. That was stupid. "I see," Araminta said. Her knowledge of the whole Water Walker epic was sketchy at best. She certainly did not know any details. "That's why you want to live here." Marebel nodded eagerly. "I'm convinced the second dreamer is here. One day soon he'll reveal himself, and then pilgrimage can begin. Will you join it?" They smiled at each other and clasped hands again. "We hope so." "Well, at the risk of being crass, you won't find anywhere better to wait than here." "I think we can consider putting in an offer," Danal said. "An uncomfortable number of our fellow followers are looking for property on Vyosha. Living in a hotel is pleasant, but we'll be happy to move into a real home."
"That I can fully appreciate."
"We're prepared to offer you the full asking price, but we would need a guarantee that the apartment will be completed on time." "I can put my certificates on that file, yes. And the virtual model we accessed. It was nice, but..."
"I want to make some changes," Marebel said quickly. "The technology needs to be de-emphasized, and the decor should be more naturalistic."
"Naturalistic?"
"Less manufactured products, more wood, as it is on Quarentia. We're not against technology, we use it all the time, but it shouldn't be featured. For instance, you can install a proper cooker in the kitchen, one with an oven and hob."
"I'll check city regulations and get back to you on that one." "So you can supply me with a proper cooker?" she asked Mr. Bovey that night over dinner. She was at his house, sitting at a small table on the balcony that overlooked the lawn. The river cairns ran along the bottom edge, where the mown grass gave way to shaggy reeds and a lengthy clump of Koran twister trees that dangled chrome-blue fronds into the water. Bright lights in the buildings along the opposite bank glinted off the smooth black surface. It was a lovely, relaxing ambience, with a delicious meal. Several of Hims had cooked, and three of Hims, sitting with her, a pleasant end to an exasperating day. "Actually, yes," the handsome blonde one said.
"You say that with such confidence."
"Because I've already supplied three in the last 10 days, the shorter one with a dark complexion told her. "Living dream fanatics do like their primitive comforts. They prefer water baths to spore showers, too.
Dear Ozzy, my cousin was right. They are taking over.
I ought to raise the price on the last two apartments. I don't want to throw a damper on the evening, but I actually find that prospect quite disturbing, mainly because it's rapidly becoming true. There are a lot of them here now. Millions.
I'd have thought the rush for housing will benefit you as much as me, probably more so."
"Financially, yes," the blonde said, holding up a kebab of spiced torkal and pork marinated in red honey. "But multiples don't fit into the living dream ethos." He bit into the meat and started chewing.
"We didn't exist in Makathran," the Oriental one explained.
"Surely they're not against your lifestyle, are they?
She had an unpleasant thought of how devoted Marebel and Danal were to their ideology, to the complete exclusion of just about everything else. That did not make them hostile, just unaccepting. Oh, never actively, no, perish the thought. Their precious water walker wanted everyone to live together and get along without conflict. But tell me this. How did your buyers react when they found out you weren't sharing the glory that exists only within the Gaia field? Surprised, she admitted. Then I think they wanted to convert me. I bet they did. It won't last long, she assured him. As soon as the pilgrimage starts, they'll all flock away to join it. My couple told me that. They're only here because they think this is where the second dreamer is hiding. Which is equally disturbing. Why? She asked, as she poured herself some more of the excellent rosé wine. If you're the next chosen one, why hide? And more than that, why keep releasing the dreams that let everyone know you exist and are in hiding?
I don't understand anything about living dream. The whole thing seems stupid to me.
The word you're looking for is dangerous, the short one said. Too many impossible promises, too many people believing. Bad combination.
You're an old cynic.
All three of hims at the table lifted their wine glass. Guilty, and proud of it.
You have Gaia motes. Are the second dreams real?
Is a dream real? Three mouths grinned in unison. The dreams exist. Everything else is down to personal perspective. If you want to believe in them, then the second dreamer is somewhere out there receiving dreams from a Sky Lord somewhere inside the void. If not,
I don't know what to believe. I'm almost tempted to get Gaia motes just to find out.
Take it from me, said the blonde. It's not worth it. The Gaia field is just another fad that got hijacked by a bunch of fanatics.
Why did Ozzy invent it?
He said so that people could understand each other better. If we had more empathy, we would be more peaceful.
Nice theory. Haven't seen it having much effect on human nature recently. Yet you wouldn't exist without it.
And you think you're the future. The Oriental Mr. Beauvais produced a modest smile.
True. And I doubt Ozzy envisaged us either.
She held her wine glass close to her face and dropped her gaze demurely.
I never envisaged you.
There's a lot of things we don't know about until we encounter them. The Oriental Mr. Beauvais pressed up against her and plucked the glass from her hands. She liked the warmth of him against her. On her other side, the blonde one stroked her cheek and turned her unresisting head for a kiss. She closed her eyes. Hands stroked her spine. Hands stroked her legs. The kiss went on and on.
Come with me, one of hims instructed.
The kiss ended and she saw all three of him smiling in that way, gentle and knowing, not bothering to conceal his anticipation. The three hims escorted her to a warm second-floor bedroom, where the lighting was a cozy candle-flame orange. She stood at the end of the bed while they stripped in front of her, just the way she liked, making her the center of attention, the center of desire. Then it was her turn, removing her clothes slowly, showing herself off, drinking in the admiration from hims, exultant with approval. When she was naked, Hees began to explore her flesh with formidable intimacy.
Yes,
she finally shuddered in delight, and they lifted her onto the bed. Rushing headlong through space, the creature could feel stray molecules kiss its broad vacuum wings as it stretched them wide. Scintillations from the tenuous impact dripped from its trailing edge, leaving a weak contrail of fluorescence through the empty gulf. Ahead, a star gleamed bright against the glorious background of an undulating turquoise nebula, creating a warm pressure of photons that so very slowly supplied its physical nourishment. The creature spun leisurely in the rich torrent of light as it listened to the thoughts grow stronger on the solid planet that was still light years away. One thought was exceptionally clear. You see, you have to rest now. If you were multiple, another body could simply carry on. The ecstasy would continue for hours. More bodies could perform at the same time. Imagine that pleasure you've just experienced, doubled, quadrupled, increased tenfold. Wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't your life be so much better, so much greater?
The thought dwindled away into the vastness as the solar wind cooled and dimmed. There were only two of him asleep on the bed when Araminta woke. She checked the time in her exovision and groaned in dismay. 7:05 already. There was so much to do in the third apartment today. The bots should have spent the night stripping the old tiles in the fifth apartment, but her U-shadow revealed that they had stopped work at 3 a.m, when they had encountered a problem their semi-sentient software could not cope with. She had 2 prospective buyers for apartment 4 arriving before noon. "Great, Ozzie," she complained as she heaved herself out of bed. No time for a shower. She grabbed the clothes she had worn the previous night, which really were not everyday garments. Must bring a bag with some decent clothes for morning. Would he object to that? She escaped the bedroom without waking the Mr. Bovies and scuttled down the stairs, raking fingers through awful strings of tangled hair. The smell of coffee and toast was permeating out of the big kitchen. It was sorely tempting given her body's chill. I must ease off those booster aerosols. Surely a single minute spent with one cup of tea wouldn't jeopardize the whole day. She put her head around the archway to smile into the long open-plan kitchen diner. 5 of hims were sitting at the breakfast bar, with another 3 lounging in the big old settee. "Hi." The smile faded from her face. A woman was perched on the 6th stool at the breakfast bar, wearing a big fluffy toweling robe. One of hims had his arm around her, his hand lovingly massaging the base of her neck. The woman glanced up from a big mug of steaming coffee and pulled a delinquent face. "Oh, hi there. I'm Jocil. I guess I was being worn out by the half of hims you weren't with last night. He's good sex, huh? I managed 4. She grinned proudly at her entourage of Mr. Bovies. Araminta managed to freeze her expression before she did anything petty, like glare or pout or start shouting about what a useless pile of shit he was. "Right," she said in a croak. "Got to go. People I'm honest with are coming to see me." She headed for the front door as fast as she could without actually running, even managed to get outside. Her old carry capsule was resting on the gravel pad 15 meters away. "Just hold on." She turned. It was the body she had had that first dinner date with. He always used that one to talk to her when it was something serious, obviously working the whole age equals wisdom angle with maybe a little trust mixed in. "Drop dead," she snapped. "All of you. You knew I would date other women." "I..." She sputtered with indignation. "No, actually, no, I didn't. I thought we..." Some stubborn little part of her was trying desperately not to cry in front of him. What the point was, with someone who knew her so completely, eluded her. Still, she was not going to give him the satisfaction of seeing how much she cared. "Listen to me." He stood in front of her, taking a moment to compose himself. "You are a lovely, fantastic person. I haven't met someone I was this attracted to in years. And I think you know that." "Well, this is a..." "Funny way of showing it?" "No. No. That's a single person's line, not mine." "How ridiculous," she shouted. "Maybe you've been trying to hide from this. I don't know. Adjusting to multiple life does take time. It isn't easy. And you're upset." "I'm not upset," she announced haughtily. "I have a great time with you every time, no matter where we go and what we do, and that's the problem. Think on this. You are a wonderful, healthy, strapping girl with a huge sexual appetite. Every man's dream. And I'm always amazed and excited by how many of me's you take on when we go to bed. But not even you can physically satisfy 38 male bodies every night. We've been going out all this time, and there are still some me's you haven't met, let alone had sex with yet. You get me all hot and randy. And every time you do that, the majority of me's are left frustrated. I..." "Oh, really?" It was kind of obvious when he explained it like that. But he was right. It really was not something she wanted to think through. "I can only take so much. Jocil and the others help release the pressure you create." "Others." Again, something she did not want to consider. This whole multiple thing was turning out to be a giant complication. She took a breath and stared at the gravel around her feet.
I'm sorry. You're right. I didn't consider that part of it. It's been so good for me. I just assumed it was the same for you.
Singles thinking, huh?
Yes.
He put a hand on her shoulder. It comforted her, that whole wise and sympathetic thing. But I'm hoping, really hoping, we can work through this. She gave the door a guilty glance.
I'm not sure I can get around the idea of you having sex with her as well. Were you...
No, I don't want to know. He raised an eyebrow and waited patiently. Araminta sighed.
Last night, were you having sex with both of us at the same time?
Yes. A particularly malicious thought crept out of her mind.
And she could only cope with four?
Afraid so.
Poor girl.
Her little spike of humour withered away.
I don't know about this. I'm not sure I can cope. There would need to be so many women. That's not part of a long-term relationship.
Listen, I said you were special right at the start. And the more I get to know you, the more I know that I don't want to lose you.
So what do? Get half of you neutered? I really can't. Not 38.
He grinned. That's my Araminta. Considering it even now. But there's another option, isn't there?
What?
He did not answer right away. Instead, his hand touched her chin, tipping her head back until she couldn't avoid staring into his eyes. Eventually, she gave a defeated little nod.
I get myself some extra bodies,
she said in a quiet voice. I'm not going to browbeat. I couldn't do that to you. It would be wrong. The decision has to be yours alone. I just want you to think about it. You've seen all the practical benefits firsthand, and I reminded you about the sexual advantages again last night. She fixed him with a firm stare.
Tell me, if I do this,
would you stop dating the other women? Would it be just you and me?
Yes,
emphatically. Just you. Yous in my life. Yous in my bed. Cross my hearts. I want this, Araminta. I want this so much. I wish you had Guyamote so I could show you just how serious I am. We'll just have to settle for registering it at City Hall instead.
Hozzy! A marriage proposal and a lifestyle change in one, and it's not even 7:30 yet.
Sorry you had to run into it like this.
Not your fault. You're right. I should have thought about this. So I'll be a big girl and think about it properly now. Don't expect an answer right away. This is a hell of a lot more than I'm used to dealing with in a day.
His arms went around her, hugging tight as if he were the one seeking reassurance.
It's momentous.
I remember. So take all the time you need.
He rode the gigantic horse for hour after hour, his young legs barely stretching over the saddle. In the distance were real mountains, their snow-capped peaks stabbing high into the glorious sapphire sky. He was leaving them behind, riding away from the forests that covered the foothills. It was wild veldt beneath the hooves now, lush tropical vegetation split by streams and small rivers. Trees from a dozen planets grew across the low slopes, their contrasting evolutions providing a marvelous clash of color and shape. Hot air gusted against him, heavy with alien pollen. His friends rode beside him, the six of them shouting encouragement to one another as they wove around the knolls and ridges. None of them were yet adult, but they were finally old enough to be trusted out on their own. It was days like this, full of freedom and joy, that made sense of his life. Then the cry went up, "The King Eagles! The King Eagles are here!" He scoured the brilliant sky, seeing the black dots above the rumpled horizon. Then he too was yelling in welcome, his heart pounding with excitement. The horse ran faster as the noble lords of this world's sky grew larger and larger. Red lights flashed across the heavens. The King Eagles elongated, black lines curving and twisting to form a grey rectangular shape. His horse had vanished, leaving him lying flat on his back. The red lights turned violet-blue and began to retreat as the top of the medical chamber opened. A face slid into view, peering down. He blinked it into focus. It was very pretty and heavily freckled, with a mass of dark red hair tied back.
"You okay?"
Corilin asked.
"Ah,"
Aaron told her.
"Here, drink this."
A plastic straw was eased into his mouth. He sucked some welcoming cool liquid down his sore throat.
"What?" he mumbled.
"What?
What happened?"
"You've been in the ship's medical chamber for a couple of days." He winced as he tried to move his arms. His whole left side was stiff, as if the skin had shrunk.
"A moment," he told her.
His U-shadow flipped medical records into his exovision. He skipped the details, concentrating on the major repairs. The damage had been more extensive than he had expected. The projectile entry wounds, combined with firewire mutilation and toxin contamination, meant the medical chamber had had to cut and extract a lot of ruined tissue and bone from his chest. Foreign meat had been inserted, neutral function cells that could have their preactive DNA switched to mold them into whatever organ, bone, or muscle function they were replacing. He spotted a supplementary file and opened it. The foreign meat stored in the chamber actually was not so foreign. The DNA was his. It also had full complement bionic organelles. The repairs had been woven into his body by the chamber and his existing bionics. They were still integrating, and that was why he felt so awful. Estimated time for the bionics to complete the binding and the cells to acclimatize to their new function was a further 72 hours.
Could have been better. Could have been worse, he decided.
I was worried, she said.
Your wound was huge. The blood.
Her face paled. Even the freckles faded. Aaron slowly shifted his arms back along the chamber padding, propping himself up, at which point he realized he did not have any clothes on.
Thank you.
She gave him a blank look.
I should be thanking you, shouldn't I? What happened? The last thing I remember was you hitting Ruth's stall.
That little princess bitch. So, what came next? Aaron swung his feet over the lip of the capsule. His inner ears seemed to take a lot longer than usual to register the movement. Bulkhead spun around him, then twisted back. The starship's cabin was in its lounge mode, with long couches extending out from the bulkhead walls. He hobbled over to the closest one as the medical chamber withdrew into the floor. Sitting down, he tentatively poked his chest with a forefinger. Half of his torso was a nasty salmon pink, covered with a glistening, protective membrane.
I did what you suggested, Corilin said. The capsule smashed its way into the reception hall. I just got inside when there was this almighty explosion over the forest. It knocked the capsule around quite a bit, but I was caught by the internal safety field. We zipped over to the administration block. You were a mess, but I managed to pull you inside.
Then we rendezvoused with the Artful Dodger outside the clinic, the way you set it up. The starship put its force field around the capsule while we transferred in.
Good job.
The police were going apeshit with me. They were shooting every weapon they had at us. There were craters all over the place when we took off. I told the smart core to get us out of the system, but it followed your preloaded flight plan. We're just sitting in some kind of hyperspace hole a light year out from Anagaska. I can't make a Unisphere connection. The smart core won't obey me.
I loaded a few options in, he said. His U-shadow gave the smart core an instruction and a storage locker opened.
Do you think you could get me that robe, please?
She frowned disapprovingly, but pulled the robe out.
I was really worried. I thought I was going to be stuck here forever if you died. It was horrible.
The medical chamber would rejuvenate me every 50 years, and I'd just sit in the lounge, plugged into the sensory drama library, being drip-fed by the culinary unit. That's not how I want to spend eternity, thank you.
He grinned at her drama queen outrage as he slipped on the robe. If the chamber could rejuvenate you, it would certainly re-life me.
Oh.
In any case, if I die, the smart core allows you full control.
Right.
But, he caught hold of her hand. She jerked around, suddenly apprehensive. None of this would have happened if you'd been ready to pick me up when I told you.
I haven't seen any decent clothes in weeks, she protested. I just lost track of time, that's all. I didn't mean to be late. Besides, I thought you got wounded before the scheduled rendezvous.
He closed his eyes in despair. Corilin, if you're on a combat mission, you don't call a fucking time out to go shopping. Understand?
You never said combat. A quick raid sneaking into their vault, you said.
For future reference, a covert mission in which all sides are armed is a combat situation.
She pulled a face. Nothing they have will be a match for my bionics.
I never said that.
Yes, you did.
He let out a breath and made an effort to stay calm.
Yoga. She always made us do yoga.
It was fucking stupid.
Corilyn was frowning at him.
You okay?
You need to get back in the chamber.
I'm fine. Look, thank you for picking me up. I know this kind of thing is not what your life is about.
You're welcome, she said gruffly.
Please tell me we still have the memory cell.
Corilyn produced a mink smile and held up the little plastic cube.
We still have the memory cell.
Thank Ozzy for that.
His U-Shadow told the smart core to show him the ship's log. He wanted to check how much effort had been made to try to track them. Since they had left Anagaska in a hurry, several starships had run sophisticated heist radar scans out to several light years, but nobody could spot an ultra-drive ship in trans-dimensional suspension. The log also recorded that Corilyn had managed to circumvent the lockout he had placed on the culinary unit to prevent it from making alcoholic drinks. This really wasn't the time to make an issue of it.
Okay, he told her. I don't think anyone spotted us, though there were some mighty interesting comings and goings just after our raid. Several ships with unusual quantum signatures popped out of hyperspace above Anagaska. The Smart Corps thinks they might be ultra drives in disguise.
Who would they be?
Don't know and don't intend to hang around to ask. Let's get going.
Finally.
He held his hand out, carefully maintaining a neutral expression.
Corilyn gave the cube a sentimental look and took a while to drop it into his palm.
I'm not sure I like the idea of you reading Inigo's mind.
I'm not going to. Memory assimilation isn't like accessing a sensory drama off the Unisphere or accepting experiences through the Gaia field. A genuine memory takes a long time to absorb. You can compress it down from real time, but still this cube contains nearly 40 years of life. That would take months to shunt into a human brain. It's one of the governing factors in creating real-life clones. If we're going to find him before the pilgrimage, we don't have that much time to spare.
So what are you going to do?
Take it to someone who can absorb it a lot quicker than I can and ask nicely.
You just said human brains can't absorb stored memories that quickly.
So I did, which is why we're setting course for the High Angel.
Corilyn looked shocked.
The Rael starship?
Yes.
Why would the Rael help you?
He smiled at the cube. Let's just say that we now have an excellent bargaining chip.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.